Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake, and this is the New Books Network. We are joined today by Kimberly Brownlee. She is a professor of philosophy at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And she joins us today to talk about her latest book, Being Sure of Each Other, an essay on social rights and freedoms. Kimberly, thanks so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
It's my pleasure, Ian. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, this is a monograph on what you have characterized as an argument in favor of a human right against social deprivation. So you talk about the underpinnings of this right and you explain it and defend it. But I want you to start off with telling us why you felt that a book on or why you felt that it was important to make an argument in favor of such a right.
The idea for the book developed after I read a New Yorker article by Atul Gawande in 2009. He wrote an article called Hell Hole, where he was looking at maximum security prisons in the United States. And he argued that being held in solitary confinement is essentially torture. And he looked at the experiences that other people have had in extreme isolation where it's not coercive. So the solo sailor who sails around the world, the astronaut who goes into space, the military personnel who spend time in isolation. And his interviews with them and the other research he did showed that they found not the 50-foot waves or the illness the hardest part, it was the isolation. It was being alone and feeling alone. And so his thought was when we put someone into solitary confinement, we force them to be alone. We force them to wait impotently for someone to come to them. We deny them so many goods that we take for granted outside of isolation. And I found this article very inspiring, but also incomplete. And my thought was that if someone had the military training or the monastic training that enabled them to not find this torturous, you know, to manage to get by in isolation or perhaps even to thrive in, you know, contemplative solitude, you know, exceptional people they'd have to be, they would still be experiencing a human rights violation. And that's because we are deeply social. We have the longest period of abject dependency of any species. So, you know, we are children for a very long time. We spend most of our waking hours with other people. According to psychologists, we actually like that better. We like being with other people more than being alone. And, you know, our brains are programmed to think about other people, to think about our social needs, our social networks. And so the idea for the book really started with a reaction to this article, that it was onto something really important to highlight that solitary confinement can feel like torture, can be torturous, but that it would still be a human rights issue even if it weren't.
So ultimately, this comes back to it. In your final chapter, you talk about prisons in particular and solitary confinement. And that's a very special population. There are arguments for and against the use of solitary confinement. But before we get to that, the vast majority of your book, 90%, I guess, of your book is not about prisoners, but about individuals in a variety of different contexts. And when I was reading it, I thought about what in some way is one of the implicit understandings and norms that we get from the ancient philosophers like Aristotle and Plato, which is that we are social creatures. But your book, it seems to me in some ways, and there is a question in this, it seems to me that your book in some ways would not have been possible but for modern psychological science. Do you agree with that?
I think that's right. So you know, a very well-known thought from Aristotle, which I reference, that he said, without friends, we would not choose to live, even if we had all the other goods. So you know, and Western moral philosophy has appreciated this thought, you know, sort of from ancient times, but it's not always forefronted, or there's lip service paid to this idea that we're deeply social, but then we have this image of, you know, sort of the independent individualist, the rational person who can choose to engage but can also choose not to engage, the person who can exercise freedom of association and get by with others. And much more recent work, particularly feminist philosophical work, has stressed that actually autonomy requires interdependence, you know, that we are fundamentally relational. And now the psychology work is starting to back that up. There's very interesting work done by Matthew Lieberman, by John Cacioppo and others, Pamela Quartel, Louise Hockley, and they essentially show that the most important needs we have are our social needs. You know, that we, you know, we will not develop as children unless we are nurtured and cared for by a small set of persistent caregivers. We won't get our physical and subsistence needs met unless we are protected by others. When we're adults, we won't access resources. We won't have access to many of the great goods in life unless we are interconnected with others. And then as we age, we return again to a state of dependency, where we need other people in order to survive. And all of what I've just said, that's framed still in fairly individualistic language. But the reality is that we are in a way much more a we than an I and a you who come together. That you know, we live our lives collectively. We depend on each other to be who we are, essentially.
And so the deprivation that you're arguing against, you couch it in the form of rights. So throughout the book, you describe the conclusion is that there is a right to something. So what do you mean? Right is a word that could have multiple meanings. So what is it that you mean when you say that we ultimately have a right against social deprivation? We can talk about social deprivation in greater detail, but what's the right part of that?
So this is a human right in my view. So it, you know, the rights come in different flavors. They're the rights that we get, you know, when someone makes a promise, you know, you promise to meet me at 3 o'clock. I have some claim, some right that you will honor that promise and, you know, and meet me at 3 o'clock. That is absolutely not a human right. A human right is, first of all, it identifies a fundamental human need, a fundamental human interest. So our, you know, we have an interest in education, we have an interest in shelter, we have an interest in being able to vote, being able to practice our religion, being able to move freely. So that's the first test, you know, is there a fundamental interest on the table? And the second test is this fundamental interest one that needs protection? So in a way, the list of human rights has to be responsive to our circumstances. You know, so at the very abstract level, we could identify some things that are constants, you know, the right to life, the right to physical security, the right to have basic substance and shelter needs met. But other rights, like a right to breathable air, we haven't actually spent much time focusing on that right. We haven't, in a way, needed to enumerate it, because until fairly recently, you know, this one hasn't been under threat. But as you know, as the climate crisis becomes more extreme, it becomes more important to start identifying that kind of right. Now, in the case of our social needs, the human right against social deprivation, I formulated that right in negative language, you know, a right against a particular privation. But you could formulate it positively as a right to have adequate access to inclusion, a right to have decent social access. And I think if I were to write the book again, I might take that more positive language, because we don't want to forget that there are positive duties that correlate with this right. So that's why we talk about, you know, freedom from poverty. It's meant to, or your right to be free from poverty is meant to be a little less negative in formulation than other ways we might put it. So human rights are very special. They're the brute moral minimum. These are the most basic things we owe to each other as human beings. And so that's the kind of right I have in mind when I'm talking about social deprivation.
Of course, you've got two different notions of the right there. On the one hand, you said as you've written the book, it's in terms of preventing the deprivation of human connectedness and or interactions. And so that's a right to not have something forbidden to you or taken away from you. But on the other hand, if you wrote it differently, if you rewrote the book, you might write it in, as you say, a positive sense, which sounds like it's a different way of construing a right, which is an entitlement to something to be provided to you, not merely to be protected from deprivation, say, like in the context of a prisoner in solitary confinement in a prison, but rather some kind of affirmative entitlement to connectedness. And that, it seems to me that that's not merely the flip side of the same coin, but it entails certain obligations that may not be entailed if you simply have a deprivation of a right that you're concerned with. Do you agree with that?
So most human, if not all human rights, actually have positive elements to them. So the right to life isn't just a right not to be killed. Henry Shue highlighted this point very well in his book Basic Rights, and it's now the 40th anniversary of the publication of that book, and he's got a new edition out to honor that. And so the right to life, it's not just a right not to be killed, it's also a right that there be a functioning law enforcement system, there be a functioning police force that will actually actively help to protect your life from, you know, third parties, from other threats to your life. Same with the right for due process. That requires a very expensive legal and political apparatus to be in place. There are positive duties that the state has to provide mechanisms to ensure you can have due process. The right to vote, freedom of movement, all of these have hidden or not so hidden positive sides to them. So I think the takeaway is that all human rights actually turn out to be expensive. It's not just the ones that look expensive on their face. You know, the right to be free from poverty, the right to education, right to health, you know, they look expensive. We have to have an education system, healthcare system, and so on. But these other ones are also expensive.
So in terms of the flip side of deprivation, what then is how would we describe the affirmative right, the positive right?
Yeah.
Is it social connectedness? Is it the ability to interact? You go into great depth in exploring the different kinds of interactions that people might have in various hypothetical situations. You use a lot of literature as well to use scenarios from fictional works. So what is the affirmative or positive description of the right that you're talking about?
So it depends. The positive element depends a little bit on who you are or what stage of life you're at. So if you're a baby, the positive side is persistent, caring, nurturing. I stop short of saying you have a right to be loved in childhood. But another philosopher, Matthew Liao, he has written a book called The Right to Be Loved, where he argues that we do have a human right during childhood to be loved. And so not just to be nurtured and cared for and fed and socialized, but to be cared for by people who have an overall positive, affectionate attitude toward us, who want to be close to us, who value us for our own sake, that there, you know, there are strong emotional components to that. So I stopped short of that, but you know, in certainly babyhood, childhood, you have very strong positive rights to be nurtured by a small set of caregivers. When you become an adult, it depends again on how your life is going, what stage you're at. So we all experience moments of extreme dependency, illness, injury, loss of employment, migration, a period in prison, returning to society. There are many, you know, giving birth, facing the death of a loved one, grieving. There are many moments in our lives where we need positive support, positive provision. And then there's, for some people, those moments of support requirement, their default. If someone who's physically impaired and who needs someone to come to their house in order for them to stay social, we have to pay attention to that in order to honor their right to have adequate social access. As we move into dependency and old age, it becomes more the default for most of us to need someone to come to us, need someone to support us to stay social. If you happen to be, you know, fully able-bodied and, you know, seemingly independent as an adult, then your positive rights are to have adequate opportunities, adequate chances to meet people, to re-meet people, to form bonds, to have those bonds be protected, not forcibly severed by the state or by third parties. So there's the protection of your interests as opposed to the positive provision of care and support that is your positive right.
So you start out discussing that there is a distinction between merely surviving and in fact flourishing. What is this right doing if it is protected or if it is provided? Is it a right to merely survive in terms of a minimum degree of social interaction? Or is it a right to flourish?
So human rights are not built to guarantee flourishing. That's not their political function. That's not how they're conceptually specified. They're meant to be about the basics. What's the minimum that we owe to each other? And so the human right against social deprivation or the human right to have adequate social access, that will not guarantee you a friend. And in my mind, that's one of the reasons to stop short of saying there's a right to be loved. And the way being loved is about flourishing, it's about richness. And it would only be if you couldn't lead a minimally decent life without being loved that we could talk about a human right to be loved. Now Liao does think that. He takes a slightly stronger view of what human rights are meant to secure. So I use the language of minimally decent. What makes for a minimally decent human life? He talks about what makes for a good human life, which is a higher bar. But if we're focusing on minimally decent, then we're not in the realm of goodness or flourishing. This is just about the basics.
You use the example of air to breathe, and that there arguably should be. Obviously, oxygen is a necessity for human physical life, and it is a bare minimum need. But at the same time, as you noted, we haven't really had to think of it as a right that needs protecting or provisioning because there was no problem with scarcity. Is there a problem with scarcity in regard to social interaction?
Yes and no. So the yes is that social resources necessarily rest with people. So and there's only so many people that any one person can support and care for and be connected with and be intimate with and even know the name of. There's a psychologist say that the upper limit of the number of names we can actually hang on to in our minds is about 150, which is the, that's the rough and ready number of people who would be in a tribe. And so there may be, sort of part of our history, part of our ancestry, that may be our typical upper limit. So we're limited in the resources available to support each other, but we're not limited in the attitudes we can take. We can cultivate an attitude of open-hearted well-wishing toward everyone. That sort of state of mind and heart that it doesn't have to be limited. And the way psychologists talk about this is that there's actually a multiplicative effect in loving, that it sort of ripples out. It benefits, the sum's greater than the parts, the whole is greater than the parts, and that you, if you sort of send love and warmth and well-wishing elsewhere, it expands, it ripples back, and it amplifies. So yes, social resources are limited in that, we are limited creatures who can only be into so many, but not in terms of our attitude.
Beyond, and I want to return to prisons, because ultimately that's what you are concluding with, is the institutional problems that prisons and solitary confinement present. It seems to me in some ways that's a special case, whereas you've got an institution, a public institution, that's enforcing solitary life upon somebody. And I'm concerned with more mundane, quotidian things like you refer to, for example, the elderly caregiver in Canada, I believe it was in Canada, who had been or was about to be deported and had been a caregiver for many years for another elderly woman. And can you explain that story and how that was, it became kind of a cause célèbre?
Yeah, so these two women, they weren't married, they weren't in a romantic partnership, they were lifelong friends, and they were living in Canada, and the American woman had sort of expired, her visa had expired, her right to stay had expired, and so the Canadian government was about to deport her. And there was a big reaction to this that their relationship somehow didn't have the same pedigree, the same standing that a marriage might have, and so she was actually granted 3 months reprieve on compassionate grounds, and I believe that was extended. And the story's now dropped out of the headlines. I went and searched for it again and couldn't find an update, but the thought was that here the state was giving. These women potentially weren't being rendered so socially deprived. If they had other contacts and connections, if they were embedded with a broader social circle, then they weren't being put below a minimum level of sufficiency socially. But their most important connection was being severed. And that, I think, is, in a way, that's the element of flourishing that the human rights must protect. So, someone who's in a sort of a wonderful, happy marriage is living well above the threshold of of human rights, brute moral minimum standard. But if a government were to forcibly sever your marriage, that would be an assault on your human rights. That once you've formed bonds and established bonds, to forcibly sever them is in a way to take advantage of this deep social nature we have, to use it against us as a form of punishment or cruelty. And then we're in the territory of human rights.
Well, we arrest people all the time and send them away to prison for years. They are in relationships that are, some of which are presumably loving, lifelong, dedicated relationships, parent-child, siblings, as well as spousal relationships. And the purpose, of course, of the separation is to punish them for the wrong they've done, also to perhaps deprive them of the ability to do future wrongs, commit other crimes, and for obvious deterrent effect. So is the mere nature of arrest and confinement, I don't mean solitary confinement, but just simply the separation of somebody who's been convicted, charged, and then later convicted, is that impinging upon this right that you have been describing?
Yes. So prison officials know that the most powerful carrot and stick they have is people's family. And so there's, you can use access to family visits to get the behavior you want. And indeed, you can use the threat of going in the isolation wing and the segregation wing to get behavior that you want. Now, in my mind, that access should not be a privilege that can be revoked. It should be a guaranteed claim right you have to have access to family, not to be housed in a prison 100 miles away from your family that really makes it difficult for them to visit. Not to be denied access to your children. This territory should be off limits as part of punishment methods. And indeed, in some societies, punishment is practiced in a way that is much more compatible with retaining our social connections. Norway is one of my favorite examples, that they have something called weekend prison, where you show up on Friday evening, you stay in prison over the weekend, you do sort of community service work or certain types of labor as your part of your contribution, and then you return to your home on Monday. You can keep your job, you can stay connected with your children and your family, far less brutal in terms of its assault on your social connections.
Of course, you can anticipate the objections to this. Norway has a distinctly small population. It's very homogenous. And you compare it to, say, in the modern United States and a nation of 330 million with all of the various stratifications, socioeconomic, cultural, etc., that the character of the violent criminal segment of the society, that kind of weekend prison model probably would be infeasible. Do you think that's true? Or do you think that even if it were less feasible, that it would still be worth trying in order to, with part of the objective being to try to protect this social right that you're describing?
So Anglo-American criminal justice systems tend to be harsher along a variety of measures than European systems. That there are offenses that would land you in jail in the United States that would not land you in jail in Europe. There are offenses where justices have some discretion, whether to send you to prison or to assign community service. And in more often than not, the Anglo-American systems seem to opt for the harsher responses than more milder ones. There's also differences in treatment overall. So in many European countries, prison guards are required to address people in their custody by their first name, by their formal name, or their chosen name. Whereas in many Anglo-American prisons, people are referred to as, well, we're moving these bodies from here to there, or it's feeding time rather than we're serving lunch. And I've worked with a couple of prisons in the UK that are trying to change their language, and that they see that as an important part of moving beyond a very dehumanizing and excessively punitive system. So, instead of having a bin man, you have a maintenance technician. Instead of having a greeter, you have an information ambassador. And that the people in the prison are residents, not prisoners. Now, I think that last term is maybe unnecessary, that you are imprisoned. You are a prisoner. Political prisoners, people who are imprisoned for criminal offenses, you are imprisoned as a prisoner. But other labels that we tend to use, I think we should drop. We should refer to someone as a person who has committed a sexual offense, a person who has committed a rape, and that it's much easier to desist when your life isn't reduced to your offense.
So in describing the balance between recognition and protection of social rights that you're describing, the right against deprivation, you also describe perhaps a countervailing force, if you will, which is the ability or perhaps even the right to disassociate or dissociate from another. So can you explain the tension here and what in fact dissociation means in terms of the way you're describing it or using it?
So there's part of our commitment to to liberalism in many democracies, the idea that we can sort of list on our fingers some core freedoms we have. John Stuart Mill is a key influential figure in this domain. We have freedom of thought, freedom of expression, the freedom to shape our life according to our tastes and interests, freedom of movement, and freedom of assembly and association, where we have the right to choose the society that is most acceptable to us. That's Mill's line. And that includes a freedom to dissociate, a freedom to step back, to retreat into life as a hermit, to exit associations when they're not working for you. But in my view, that freedom to dissociate should not take priority over positive social rights claims, or at least not generally. We have to take a very specific case-by-case approach, because we need someone to step up and take care of associative tasks. We need someone to care for every baby and every child that comes into the world. And there's very good evidence that when children are put into institutions, they fail to thrive. They fail to develop. That it's a very stunting, privative environment to be raised in an orphanage rather than to be raised in a family. And of course, not all families are perfect, and some family settings are privative as well, but very difficult to replicate the conditions you need in an institution to grow well. So, and that's then true across the board. So when someone has an existing claim on you, so when someone's your spouse, I think we need to be cautious before saying, okay, well, I have a blanket freedom to exit. This isn't working for me. My feelings aren't what they used to be. I have a right to leave. I think we can have duties first to look at this connection, to think, okay, are there things I can do to change how I feel about this relationship? Are there ways I can reinvest? Are there people I can surround myself with who will model a more loving connection with their partner, which I might try to adopt? Now, of course, some relationships are pernicious and horrific, and a victim needs to protect themselves, needs help to exit. So this isn't a blanket requirement to stay in connections that aren't functioning well. But it's to stress that we shouldn't be too quick to assume we have an absolute freedom to dissociate.
So obviously there's philosophy and then there's applied philosophy. And it seems to me that in regard to the right you're describing, the rubber hits the road when you try to figure out how you actually implement these rights and the attendant obligations that you've been describing, whether they are the obligations to continue a relationship or not simply be free to dissociate, as you just described, or the provision and protection of someone who is claiming in some fashion that, or for whom there is an argument that they are being deprived of some of these social necessities. It seems to me that government, and again, we'll get to the, we'll talk about the prisons kind of separately, but that in general, is this something that would be easily protected, or is government suited to protecting such a right as this?
So there's a role for government because human rights bring a trinity of duties to respect, to protect, and to fulfill. And again, that's a contribution from Henry Hsu. And so governments, the duty to respect starts with what are your own policies for prison, for solitary confinement, for immigration, our families being held together, our families being separated. Do children know where their parents are if they are in fact separated in an immigration facility? Are immigration facilities similar to prisons in this society? In the United States, a lot of corporations administer both prisons and immigration centers, and they look very similar in how they're run, how people are forced to dress, how they're treated, how they're fed, how they're housed. And then more generally, how is the government protecting and fulfilling the rights in terms of ensuring that third parties like corporations are not depriving people of their social needs, ensuring that care facilities are regulated in ways that attend to people's social needs, ensuring that if there are healthcare providers, healthcare visitors coming for that weekly chat, that it's the same person who comes each week instead of a different person. If the person who's receiving the social care, if they're starting over every time, then they share no history with someone. They have no common story with someone. And in the case of, in our current context of the coronavirus and lockdowns, there's an important question about whether government is paying attention to the social impact. So in the UK, when during the first lockdown in the spring of 2020, the government didn't really pay attention to the fact that people who live in a single person household, people who live alone, need to have some exemption from the requirement that you not interact outside of your house. It's about 12% of British people or the people in Britain live in a single person household now. And so in subsequent iterations of the lockdowns, the government has allowed those people to form a bubble with someone else who lives alone. And so that was a necessary refinement in the policy where the government became a bit more awake to the social impact of their decisions. Another related issue for the coronavirus is overcrowding. So, if people are required to live 24 hours a day inside their house, and their house normally is okay, has more people than it has rooms, but it's all right because people, they go out to work, they go out to school, they can go to the park. And then suddenly in a lockdown, this is a very different setting. And so, the rise in cases of abuse within families, some of that's due to people's living arrangements. And so if lockdowns are exceptional circumstances, you can deal with these problems in maybe a rough and ready way. But if lockdowns become more common, and the thought is that, pandemics may become more common, then we have to pay attention to how we're looking after housing, just what exactly we're asking people to take on when we say you have to stay inside the house for the next few weeks.
So finally, I just want to address the source of your title for your book. You quote the inestimable A.A. Milne with an exchange between Winnie the Pooh and Piglet. This was the source for your title, being sure of one another, being sure of each other, when Pooh looks back to Piglet and he says, "What's wrong?" essentially, and he says, "I just wanted to be sure of you." this notion of being sure of one another, it seems to me that what you're hoping for in this book is more than just prison reform. It's a recognition of how people are in fact connect. Is that right?
Yeah, so much so that I think this goes, this carries out into the street as well, that we really need those little moments of acknowledgement from strangers. We need to feel accepted, not just within a family, but within a broader community, within a society. And I think we're appreciating that during this pandemic, because we're getting fewer of those little moments of recognition and acknowledgement. And I maintain that we have a duty, maybe not an overriding all things considered duty, but we have a duty to respond to someone when they reach out and want our attention. Western societies, the norm lets us get away with ignoring some people. The norm is we're allowed to ignore a homeless person who bids for our attention. But I think we actually have a duty to acknowledge someone. And people who've endured homelessness, they say the hardest part is feeling invisible. Being sick, being cold, those are terrible. but it's actually worse to feel like you don't exist. And so yes, in terms of the takeaway, it's look much more than, not just at prison reform and care facility reform, which I think are necessary, but at how we operate as social creatures, and to realize the importance that the good we offer each other, the gift we offer each other when we are social.
The book is entitled Being Sure of Each Other, An Essay on Social Rights and Freedoms. And we've been joined today by its author, Kimberly Brownlee. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian.